May it please the court, my name is Kristen Paulding on behalf of the appellant Carlin Michael Jones. We are here today on one assignment of error dealing with the sufficiency of the evidence for one felony count of assault and battery on a police officer. Mr. Jones was convicted of that back in May of 2016, and the primary element that was at issue in that case was whether or not Mr. Jones had an intent to harm. Specifically, this court has held in numerous cases before it that when you have an assault and battery, not every touching is a battery. And specifically, whether a touching is a battery is going to depend on the intent of the actor and not the amount of force applied. Specifically, this court has looked at proving intent in two ways, whether there is actual intent or whether there is imputed intent. In this particular case, you have no evidence of actual intent. You have no evidence of imputed intent. And more specifically, at the sentencing hearing, Judge Lewis commented that he clearly thought that there was no intent to assault MPO Foxwell when he was trying to get away. So the trial judge's own comments made at the sentencing hearing were in direct contradiction to the verdict that came down in March.
I'll tell you, counsel, I found this case interesting and sort of, that gave me a teaching point when I talk with trial judges, when we have new trial judges come on board, is that sometimes extemporaneous comments can get you in a world of trouble. But it appears, and again, we have to look at the record as it's presented to us, that in the context of adjudicating the matter, adjudicating guilt or innocence, the trial court actually suggested conclusions inconsistent with what he suggested during the sentencing hearing. Aren't we, as an appellate court, responsible to look at the context of the trial itself as far as the adjudication of guilt or innocence, rather than consider remarks made in the context of the sentencing hearing as to whether or not the Commonwealth met its burden?
Well, I disagree, because at this particular trial, Judge Lewis, perhaps taking your advice, made no commentary in his ruling. At the conclusion of both of the motion to strike after the Commonwealth's evidence and the motion to strike after defense evidence, he simply stated, there's enough evidence, there's sufficient evidence for guilt. The first time that we actually...
Counsel, may I ask you, but didn't counsel bring up the issue about intent before the judge at least on two occasions during the actual adjudicatory, prior to the sentencing, during the actual evidentiary phase?
Yes, ma'am. That was the primary argument. So at the initial motion to strike after the Commonwealth's evidence, we argued that that intent was not present.
Judges are presumed to know the law, correct?
They are presumed to know the law. And we did present the Parrish case. We did present the Parrish case that specifically dealt with the factors with actual and imputed intent. We renewed that same motion at the end after Mr. Jones actually got on the stand and provided testimony that his intent was not to harm. But when Judge Lewis made his ruling, he gave no commentary at that point as to his reasoning. The first time that we actually hear his commentary comes at the sentencing. And I think his word choice is very specific. His language is, I remember when we tried this case thinking a number of things. Number one, the fact that Mr. Jones seems to be a very nice fellow, and clearly thinking that there was no intent to assault MPO Foxwell in trying to get away. As he was supposed to do, MPO Foxwell tried to get in his way. That's his job. That's what he's supposed to do.
Well, counsel, let's go back again to the phase of the adjudicatory hearing. When you talk about assault and battery, a battery can be simply any type of offensive touching, can it not be?
It can be.
Okay, and as a matter of fact, if you look at this case and you look at the, and I'm sure you reviewed it, the Adams versus Commonwealth case, you know, the laser
yes, ma'am.
Case, certainly the offensive touching here, apparently the judge must have thought, was either the bones rush, the grabbing of the arm, or the pushing, you know, clearly those could have been and were interpreted as offensive touchings by that judge.
Yes, ma'am. I think an offensive touching is a very subjective comment, though. I think when you look at the case law and arguing actual or imputed intent, it requires the court to go deeper. I may consider something an offensive touching that the deputy or the clerk does not. I don't agree that every single touching, it would be subjective based on the person experiencing
it. Right, and counsel, I understand your argument, but ultimately the judge was the fact finder in that case.
Yes, ma'am.
And the judge had to conclude in order to convict that those were offensive touchings.
According to the guilt finding that he made in March, yes, that's what he did conclude. I would argue, though, that based on the case that was presented and the case law that this court has handed down in the past, that's a plainly wrong decision.
Counsel, let me ask you a question, and again, this is an interesting case. When the judge made the remarks during the sentencing stage and basically suggested that maybe there's no intent here, which provides the basis for us having this argument here today, was there a suggestion at the trial level, Judge, I heard what you said in your comments regarding the sentencing, I'm asking you to set aside the original verdict because your comments would suggest, and again, you have to be delicate here, suggest that a requirement is from an element standpoint has not been met. Is that motion made?
No, that motion was not made. And as I argued in my reply brief, as counsel had argued that issue was not preserved because there was no contemporaneous objection, it was not a ruling by Judge Lewis. In fact, the entire sentencing hearing, which was roughly 45 minutes to an hour with testimony.
Well, if it's not a ruling, let me just play devil's advocate here. If it's not a ruling, then why doesn't it fall into the category that the Commonwealth suggests, which it's simply the judge trying to make a determination on sentencing and sort of softening the blow for the defendant, who the judge genuinely thinks is a nice guy?
Well, softening the blow was still a two-year sentence for my client, which was above the low end of the guidelines and different than what we had requested, which was a deviation or the detention and diversion.
But to follow up on Judge Decker's question, if we had, and I'm not suggesting that the case was not tried as best it could be, but if we had an argument, when the judge made the comment that provides the basis for us having this really good discussion today, if a motion had been made, I heard the comments, and you're suggesting that my client lacked intent, wouldn't we then have a record where we could discern what the judge really meant when the judge said these things?
I've had the pleasure of practicing in front of Judge Lewis for the last 2 years, and he's pretty clear in that he means what he says. He's a very articulate judge. He's not very vocal. He does make comments throughout the trial.
But if he meant what he said, then the next step would be, I'm rethinking the finding of guilt because of this, and I'm, you know, essentially reversing myself at this point, and he didn't do that.
He did not do that.
So,
but I think
we're left with a record. Follow me on this. We're left with a record where he makes these random statements at the time of sentencing, and then sentences the defendant, and on appeal, we view the record in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, so how do you get around that?
I don't think you can get around it. What I think it is another factor in whether or not the evidence in its whole at the trial was sufficient to prove that element of intent. I think that when he makes those comments are directly contradictory to what occurred 2 months prior at the trial phase. Because the entire trial, and at one point, myself, the Commonwealth, and the court all mentioned that it was clearly Mr. Jones's intent to simply get away from the officer. He makes that comment at sentencing. The Commonwealth argued in their closing argument that they believed it was his intent to get away, and that was the crux of my entire argument.
Well, but counsel, in his effort to elude capture, he may, according to this judge, and based upon the evidence presented from the Commonwealth, he committed offensive touching. As I mentioned earlier, there was a grab, a bones rush, and a push, and those were offensive touching that he intended to do in order to escape capture. So in reference to battery, if it's offensive, then isn't that sufficient under the case that I stated earlier, which is, you know, which was simply using a laser to point in the Adams case, using a laser to point into the officer's eyes. He didn't even touch him, but he pointed the laser in his eyes.
Well, that's where you had a discrepancy in the testimony. And specifically, the discrepancy was that Mr. Jones indicated that when he stepped or swung his legs out of the car to stand up, Officer Foxwell was hyper aware that that was a movement that he needed to do in order to... he may make that movement in order to run. So our argument at trial was that Officer Foxwell was proactive in grabbing him. And he did testify that as Mr. Jones stood up and pushed him, he was simultaneously grabbing him. I would submit to the court, and I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal if I may.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Jones. Good morning, Mr. Jones. You have 15 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am John Jones, representing Commonwealth, and we're asking the court to affirm Carlin Jones's conviction for assault and battery on a police officer, first because the current argument on appeal was not preserved below.
Let's assume that the argument was checked, because it was clear from the record as I read it, that the issue of intent was the strategy that the defense had in defense of the case. So let's assume that we made it, and let's assume, even if that's not the case, that we are looking at an ends of justice analysis. And as I hear your opponent colleague, she is suggesting that this argument goes to the heart of whether or not the defendant could be convicted because an element of the case, or an element, a factual element necessary for a conviction in this kind of case, is not here based on the judge's representations in the matter. What would you say to that, sir?
To reach this under the ends of justice, the evidence would have to affirmatively show that an element of the offense did not occur. We don't have that here. At most, there is an insufficiency of evidence. We have to go beyond that to have the evidence affirmatively show that an element did not occur.
So what are we to make of the judge's comments?
I think that there are two reasonable possible interpretations of the judge's comments. The first is what opposing counsel has forwarded as being that intent as a term of art was not present in this case. And the other is that intent, as we use it in common language, that his primary purpose was not to hurt Officer Foxwell. I think that in the context of the entire trial, and in the context of the fact that he goes on to sentence Jones right after this, that is the more likely interpretation, much more likely. It would be pretty shocking for a circuit judge in the Commonwealth of Virginia to say an essential element to the offense. I remember thinking, you know, it really wasn't there, but I'm going to sentence him anyway. That is really, that goes completely against the presumption that judges know the law. And so, given two possible interpretations and some ambiguity as to what was meant, I think that it's really clear. It's a pretty easy choice to decide which one the judge in this case meant.
And as I was going through this, I was thinking about some of the comments that I made as a trial judge during sentencing, and I thought that maybe it would be a situation where I would have a person who committed a bad act and was guilty of having committed that bad act. And in passing, I might have said, I do not believe you to be a bad person, which would negate mens rea. Thus, the person is not responsible for the crime. So is that what you think was happening here, is that the judge was sort of assessing the defendant generally as opposed to assessing his alleged criminal act?
I believe so. And if you look at the broader context, he's just listened to the defendant testify about how he wants to be with his family, he wants to be with his children. He really regrets what he had done, and he wanted to stay out, so that he could improve himself and help his family. And the judge responds to that and says, you know, Mr. Jones, I really think you're a nice guy, and I feel bad about this. But I remember clearly thinking that you were a nice fella, and that, I'm paraphrasing, and that there was no intent to assault Officer Foxwell. But I agree with the prosecutor, actions have consequences. You've committed a crime, and so here's your sentence. Yes, I absolutely believe that was what was going on, that he was trying to soften the blow.
Counsel, I think you just hit on and of course, ultimately, I personally don't see that as an issue because he'd already been convicted.
Yes,
sir. But I think you hit on the issue, just as you were talking, is that even though he may have said the issue in reference to intent, and of course he knew all along because that was what the whole argument was about in the actual trial, but he went on and said, I agree with the Commonwealth and I sentence you. So he made it clear that whatever he was saying or doing, that he didn't mean that it did not comply with the elements of the offense, because he said, I agree with their statement of the offense, of the facts of the case, and I'm going to sentence you. So that's the end of the day. I mean, that's what happened here.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And if we look at the evidence that was presented to support that verdict of guilt at the guilt phase, we can see, you know, to say that there's some conflict in testimony is to ignore the standard of review. At this stage, we're not trying to weigh the credibility of the various witnesses. It's already been weighed by the trial court. That's its province. And it adopted Officer Foxwell's testimony. And Officer Foxwell, has been pointed out, testified that Jones bum-rushed him, grabbed him, and pushed him. And there's no doubt that that is sufficient conduct to impute that intent, that wrongful intent to support the conviction. To the extent that Mr. Jones was polite before and after that, it's really irrelevant. I think that goes to why everybody thinks he's a pretty nice guy despite this commission of this crime. And it's important to remember also that parts of Jones' testimony and his companion's testimony, especially Jones' testimony, also corroborated this account that he was willing to do anything to remain a fugitive, that he did not want to go back into custody. And so that was sort of a window into his thinking, and he was willing to get it. I don't think anybody doubts that this assault was incidental to his escape, but that doesn't excuse it.
Well, counsel, you can have intent for two different things with the same intent, couldn't you?
Yes, sir. Yes.
He could intend to escape at the same time he intends to do it by whatever means, which then is the intent to push the officer out of the way.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I believe that both intents were here. I don't think that this was a, you know, if we're talking about, this isn't a transfer of intent between offenses. I know that there was another case where it was between victims, but, you know, that's a doctrine in the law, but this was not an accidental thing where he sort of brushed into him. This was very intentional conduct. And there again, you know, this gets back to the difference between intent as a term of art, as we talk about it in criminal law, and intent as we use it conversationally, that, you know, what the court is aware of the distinction there. So, yeah, I think that absolutely the evidence was sufficient, and we just have to remember to apply the standard of review on that. So if I could go back to the preservation argument just briefly and raise a couple of things. This is not merely a sufficiency challenge. This is sufficiency plus an argument that the trial court agreed with me. And I would submit this probably would not have been a granted appeal if not for the trial court's comments during sentencing. So it is absolutely essential that when the basis for the objection comes up, that a contemporaneous objection be made. And so I don't think that the court needs to reach the merits on this. It's not inclined to, because I don't believe that it was when the basis for the belief that the trial court agreed. And this came up in the questioning of my opposing counsel. Nothing was said after that. There was no, could you clarify that, Your Honor? Would you consider reconsidering in light of the fact that you just said that the intent element was not there? And the circuit court was absolutely in the best position to explain what it meant or to take proper corrective action.
This is not a case where the issue of intent was not at the forefront of the defense's strategy for defense in this case. You would agree with that?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I would agree. But the argument that the trial court agreed is what I'm saying is not preserved.
Well, clearly the trial court didn't understand that to be the issue because the trial court went on to sentence.
Absolutely.
Without an additional comment.
Yes, Your Honor. And the trial court did not have an opportunity to intelligently rule on this contention that it agreed that it
there was no contention.
Yes, Your Honor. That's something that's being argued for the first time on appeal. And so for that reason, I do not believe that it's preserved. So beyond that, I would rely on my brief and would just ask again that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Ms. Paulding?
May it please the court. The court mentioned that there could be intent for two different things, but in this case, there has to be some evidence of that intent to harm that is not related to just the touching itself. When we look at the Parrish case, we have a woman who has grabbed the male lady's arm and kind of twisted her around, or grabbed her hair and twisted her around. And the court noted that this woman was belligerent. She was yelling at her from across the street. She was extremely rude, and that was going on for an extended amount of time. And that provided context for the touching that happened itself. In Parrish, the court says that when evaluating whether this intent existed, words and prior conduct are highly relevant in shedding light on intent.
Counsel, what about he would do anything to get away?
Well, I agree that that came out, and that was part of the defense evidence. But I still do not feel that that shows that his pushing was with the intent to harm Officer Foxwell. You have to remember, Mr. Jones was 6'2", 200 pounds, and had successfully been on the run for nearly 4.5 years. If he wanted to harm Officer Foxwell, he easily could have knocked him down, punched him, tackled him, and those were pointed out specifically during the direct and cross-examination of all witnesses. There were no weapons, there was no punching, kicking, spitting, there was actually even no words. Officer Foxwell testified. He didn't even fall down. He was able to kind of stand up and brace himself, and after the initial contact, simultaneously grab Mr. Jones. We have to remember they're in a very small space. They're in basically a passenger door that is fully opened, and you have two full-grown men, one trying to get out of the car and slide past the other. The opportunity for harm would have been if there was actual harm. But we saw no injury in this particular case to Officer Foxwell throughout the entire ordeal. I submit that when Mr. Jones first recognized the police officer was at the window, his mind immediately went to, I need to create a ruse to get this officer to the trunk. I'm going to tell him my license is in the trunk, so hopefully he will walk back there or at least allow me out of the vehicle so that I can then run away. And he was confident he could outrun him. That shows the court exactly what his mindset was from the moment that that officer arrived on scene. Not to hurt this man, but simply to almost get him out of the way or to move him so that he has that direct path to run.
Which, again, counsel, is offensive conduct, is it not? I mean, I don't want to agree with me.
I don't agree with
that. But there is the issue is, you know, if there's offensive contact, then you've got a battery.
I think the court has to determine if that's offensive, and whether it's offensive is based upon the intent. What is offensive to me, I submit, would not be offensive to the court or other members in the courtroom.
Is it a subjective standard?
No. We have to look at whether or not the evidence as a whole showed that there was a touching. There's no question that you have a touching in this matter. But then the question becomes, what is the intent behind that touching? If I immediately have to run to the restroom and there's a group of attorneys at the door and I push through them quickly to go to the restroom, you could say that I was rude. You could even say that I did that in an angry manner. But did I intend to harm that group of attorneys at the door, or did I simply have another purpose to get to where I needed to go? I submit that it's really the intent in the mind of Mr. Jones in this case, or in the actor, to determine whether or not that was an offensive touching or a battery. So based upon all of the evidence and the briefs that I provided, we would ask the court to essentially reverse the circuit court's ruling and dismiss the indictment.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down and recount.